The Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Division for Monday, March 24th, 2014 will come to order. It occurs to me that I've never introduced our page to you guys, and so Chris, why don't you just come right here by a microphone and tell everybody who you are and where you're from.
My name's Chris Voller. I'm from Edina.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, they're a public school anyway, so that's good. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 bills on the agenda today. So we'll start out with Senator Housley and Senate File 2451. Senator Housley, you're becoming a regular in this committee. Maybe we should get you on it. I don't know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. Maybe I could be put on this committee next year. Work on it. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here with Senate File 2451, which is appropriating money for the city of Lake Elmo to get clean water. Senator Kent is also on a similar bill, so she's here to, if we need her to testify, she will, otherwise just for support.
And is this one is a general fund appropriation? Is Senator Kent, is yours a bonding appropriation? Is that?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay.
I've got Senate File 2295, which is a bonding bill.
And they both do the same thing?
Yes.
For the same amount of money? Okay. All right. Senator Housley, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Same amount of clean water that Lake Elmo needs. And I think you saw this. I know you saw this on your bonding tour. But with me is the mayor of Lake Elmo, Mayor Pearson, and he will go into more details about the bill.
Mayor, welcome to the committee. Just say your name for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Mike Pearson, Mayor of Lake Elmo. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, essence, Lake Elmo is here today. We're trying to run water from the northern parts of our city to the southern parts of our city to provide clean and potable water to our residents on the way and as it gets there. PowerPoint presentation will convey our situation. To begin, City of Lake Elmo requests $4 million to provide the potable water. It's roughly 42% of the project cost. City of Lake Elmo will pick up the additional 5.5. Lake Elmo finds itself in a difficult, almost debilitating situation caught between bodies of the state. We have the Metropolitan Council that mandates us to grow, and we're working hard to for that. On the other side, we've got the state lawsuit, the Attorney General, with Lake Elmo being a spin in that case. It's 3M. And as you know, so you're probably aware of the lawsuit, it involves aquifers, polluted aquifers, contaminants, PFCs, and PFOs. Lake Elmo is in the – why it's difficult for us is because we're trying to find water in the areas that we need to grow, again, from the north to the south part of our city. Here you see the city of Lake Elmo with the bottom part of the slide. You'll see the areas that we're hoping to grow. That square there represents the village of Lake Elmo. You'd find the Lake Elmo in. 30% of Lake Elmo water aquifers
– excuse me, Mayor.
Sorry?
Excuse me. Members, this is really a good PowerPoint. You guys should be watching this screen, honest to God. I mean, go ahead. Go back. Go ahead.
I appreciate that. 30% of the Lake Elmo water aquifer is adulterated with PFCs and metabolites. The next two bullet points I'd like to come back to, but basically PFCs are persistent, bioaccumulative. The Minnesota Department of Health has reported PFCs can cause significant health risks. The city of Lake Elmo, this slide represents a geographical divide. There's basically an aquifer under the city of Lake Elmo. Clean portion to the east and a polluted, contaminated portion to the west. Our problem is the areas of growth are within the contaminated aquifer. Red circle there represents well number 3 at city of Lake Elmo put in some years ago. That well shows contaminants. It hovers at or above acceptable levels. It has done so previously, and it's done so within the last 18 months. We've been told that it would not be prudent to use that well. That there are GAC filters. Our residents have them in their homes to pull out those contaminants, and 3M maintains them. over here, this circle represents an area where we'd love to put the well, where we'd love to put our new well. It's clean water. Again, it's to the east of that that line. But we've been told, and the big thing is obviously it's in the area that we hope to grow, so it's convenient. We wouldn't need the trunk lines if we're able to put it there. Problem with that is if we put a high-capacity well in that area, we've been told by several entities that we could pull the contaminants across that divide that I spoke of. If we did so, we'd be in the same shape with our well number three that we can't use, as it would incapacitate that one. I also think it could pollute other wells that are in the area. The green circle there represents where we're hoping to place the well. And if we are able to place, well, we have that well in place right now, and we can run water down Inwood Avenue to the areas of growth. Again, if we're able to do that, we'd pick up some residents around those GAC filters, abide by the Met Council mandate and the rest of it. And that last arrow there shows the completion of our system. It's the other trunk that we would need to allow it to perform hydraulically, and it's the other part of the situation that Lake Elma would pay for, again, the majority of the costs. There's well number three, contaminated. This slide actually represents some of the concerns you've heard as of late. The aquifer depletion, for instance, the lake issue. This answers that concern. What we're doing with this is we're taking the appropriation that we once had with well number three, just moving it to the north, moving it to our new well. Additionally, this is not on the same aquifer that the White that concern has. Okay? So it is not an issue.
Mayor, let me point something out here, because I'm not sure if it's your bill or if it's just that people have nothing to do today, because this is the first time that we've had full attendance at this committee in this session. So you can take credit.
It's obviously a very pressing issue.
Obviously the bill,
he's
Mr.
Here.
Chair.
He's present. He's just not in his chair right now.
He's here.
I think it's
everybody for coming that way.
Go ahead.
So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, what I'm speaking of here is, again, this isn't an issue for that aquifer drawdown for the White Bear Lake. Also sets up nicely if in the event we were to pull from surface waters down the road, as the system on the periphery of our city would be able to interconnect Mississippi, or in the event we went to the St. Croix with Wisconsin's blessings, we could pull from the St. Croix as well. So we answer the concern. The concern isn't, we don't affect the concern, but we may offer a solution in the future. So we think it's a great project. We think it, I'll answer any questions you may have.
Senator Ingebrigt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several questions. How far does this water pull? I guess you probably mentioned that. And let's go a little deeper into the GAC filter system. How many houses are being filtered now? 3M is paying for those. If this system becomes a reality, which it sounds like it certainly is the way to go here, what's 3M's responsibility from that point forward? If they're paying for the GAC filters now, that goes away. Are they going to be putting any money into this system?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I guess my first answer is I'm not sure. We're talking to 3M. How many residents are on GAC filters? I'm not sure as well. It affects three neighborhoods and some of the homes within them. Not all of the homes within them have that. But how this will impact 3M is yet to be. Well, certainly it's a benefit to them. Specific answer, I can't say.
Go ahead, follow up with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so you don't know how many filtering systems we have here. It's just two neighborhoods, you say, two city blocks in roughly? Is that?
Three. Three neighborhoods that are affected by it.
And how much, you don't know how much it costs per household. And is that water good? I mean, are they consuming that water? Is it seem
yes,
to be okay?
From what I understand, it is the systems work. We've been asked, and this is, I believe, part of Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I believe this is part of your question. If the lawsuit, if that lawsuit provides a benefit to Lake Elmo, we would definitely be willing to pay back the state for costs that we've been provided for monies that we've received from the state. So if that's part of your question, we are fully willing to pay back the state, so to speak, if the lawsuit was to provide Lake Elmo some money.
Probably what Senator Ingebrigtsen and I are thinking is, the city's going to bond for $5.5 million would seem like a natural for 3M to be throwing in some money here, and I don't know if you're negotiating with them or not, but since they're already spending some money on the filters, and since they're kind of responsible for what's going on here, you would think that they would be throwing in some money. I don't know if they are or not, though. But
They're not at this time. 3M has in the past allowed for some remediation, I guess, so to speak, in Lake Elmo. But again, the talks have stalled. There's been a lawsuit, so we've provided it. We've entered a tolling agreement with them right now to begin communications.
The filters are working just fine, but you're being forced to put in a water system. That's what kind of
right. It's the entire water system. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Yeah, it's the entire water system that would seem the answer to the issue.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So follow up. So to understand, then this water system is going to be for everybody, not just the ones on the filtering system.
That's correct.
Okay. And again, how far of a draw is that? How far is this pipe coming?
It's roughly 2 miles. The well is about 4.5 miles north of 94, south of 10th. So it's roughly, we got some water in the proximity, but it's about 2 miles, a 2 mile run on both sides. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the issue that we face, another issue like facing Lake Elmo, was there's very few users to pick up that cost on the way there. There's a large regional park reserve right in the middle of the city. So try to pull that up. Just doesn't allow for share expense. We're running it straight down there with 12 on Inwood, very few users. Eventually, if those homeowners are able to system, there'll be some sacks and or wax provided. But for the most part, because of the way the city of Lake Elmo is set up, there's very few users we can pick up to help subsidize the cost.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I don't want to belabor this, but there's talk of they're going to pay the state of Minnesota back some dollars. I guess my question would be, is that covered in this bill someplace? Is it something to worry about for this committee to be worried about? Or I guess I'm throwing that out. I didn't know that there was going to be any kind of a payback if the lawsuit determines that 3M is going to have to pay something. I mean, how far out is this lawsuit? I'm not sure what lawsuit there is. I'm not familiar with it, so... We're saying that you're going to pay it back. Is it in the bill that it is going to be paid back, or is that
Mr.
something?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, we can add that language if that would make it more. We can certainly do that.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, I guess I leave that up to the chairman here. I we got the conversation going here. It's just kind of blend.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. But I don't know that we need the language. Well, unless council's got something real quick here, but we could. I think what you should do is just have a chat with council and figure out what the language should be. We don't need to do it right now because we're going to lay it over for possible inclusion. The gray thing here that says the Met Council, through a legal memorandum of understanding, has expectations that the city of Lake Elmo will grow. What kind of expectations do they have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, had a MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, which was a mandate. We're the only city in the state that had a fine, a WIF, they were called, WIF penalties if we didn't grow. They're significant, and next check-in date, so to speak, is 2015. So we've acted against that contract. We've put some infrastructure, sewer and such in the ground already to perform on it. Right now, we're hoping to be released from that obligation, but we're still under the impetus to grow. They've issued new numbers, but we still have to grow. So it's a mandate.
What if you don't?
If we don't, there were WIF penalties in the contract that the city of Lake Elmo obligated itself to. There are significant WIF wastewater and efficiency fees, and we would have to pay them as a city.
Mr. Chair? If you'd like me to produce an amendment right now to take away their authority to force growth upon suburbs, I think we'd get lots of support from the suburbs.
You talk to the the author, and I'm fine with that. I have absolutely no idea how you can force people to grow. I mean, what if people, what if more people die than are born, or nobody moves in? I mean, what are you going to do?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yeah, it is an odd situation that Lake Elmo finds itself in. We're working with the Met Council, and we feel that we'll be released from that bondage, but the assertion is that we are going to grow, and we're trying to do just that.
Okay. Are there any other comments or questions for the senators or for the mayor? Okay. Seeing none, thank you very much. Do you have any final comments, either one of you, Senator? Okay. Then we'll lay Senate File 2451 over for... it's probably going to be a recommendation to the bonding committee, because I don't think we have this kind of money this time of year in this committee. So it'll be a recommendation to the bonding committee, okay? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Great PowerPoint, by the way, Mayor. Senate File 2656, Senator Conan.
It's there.
There. There he is.
So this whole area has to grow. They don't have any trouble.
Chris.
So this is where the water is bad. It'll grow. So how are you going to sell this property unless you can provide water that this will be
amazing.
It is amazing.
Senator Conan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And... this bill appropriates $1 million in the fiscal year 2015 from the general fund to the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development for a grant to the Southwest Initiative Foundation. And the money will be used for revolving loans and other lending programs. And I have with me today Ms. Sherry Risto and Mr. Scott Marquardt.
And who would like to go first? And whoever goes first, just say your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Sherry Ristow. I have the honor of serving as the president and CEO of the Southwest Initiative Foundation. Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Committee, and ladies and gentlemen, it's really my honor to be here want to acknowledge my colleague, Scott Marquardt, who serves as our vice president, oversees all of the economic development and lending programs at our organization. Before I begin, I do want to thank you for your own service to the people of Minnesota. We really appreciate the personal sacrifices that you make to improve our state. We're here today to speak in support of Senate File 2556, and we hope you will have five more companion bills to consider providing $1 million appropriate to each of the six Minnesota Initiative Foundations for business lending. To start, rural business and community leaders have risen to the challenge of the Great Recession and are rebounding in true Minnesota fashion with innovative strategies to overcoming job losses, but critical help is needed today. The initiative foundations are well-positioned to facilitate and assist hometown companies, emerging entrepreneurs, and community leaders across our state and rural Minnesota through the six initiative foundations. We have a strong history in rural business development. Our work across greater Minnesota began in the mid-'80s when the rural areas were facing a severe challenge. And we hope to diversify the economy beyond agriculture and mining, a counterpunch to the 1980s economic crisis, and was the creation of the six initiative foundations. Our overall purpose is to strengthen communities by providing tools and resources that build local capacity. Our premise is that local people are our greatest asset. They are the key resource. It's their ideas, energy, positive and innovative thinking. We are simply providers that provide tools to help them bring about a better future for their communities. We are a hybrid structure. This is important to note. We're a 501c3 regional community foundations with a special IRS ruling that allows us to do these lending programs. Other activities include grants to nonprofits. We do community and nonprofit capacity building programs, grassroots philanthropy across our regions, and then, again, provide business loans and investment. Our business financing, we offer a wide range of alternative financing programs, and I'm going to let my colleague Scott here talk about that in a moment. Key to our success in these investments are made against a backdrop of community development, civic engagement, and grassroots philanthropy. Thousands of Minnesotans are involved in things like our 80-plus early childhood coalitions, our leadership and worker training programs, our nonprofit capacity building, and the projects that our grants fund. They are addressing local issues like local foods, broadband, business succession, downtown revitalization, youth engagement, and much more, strengthening communities so people will want to live and invest in their communities. Everything we do is in partnership with someone. We appreciate DEED's commitment to innovation, globalization, and excellence in business and workforce programs. We remain committed to leveraging the resources of our SBDCs, engaging with our local and regional economic development organizations, and collaborating with many key partners. In closing, the Minnesota Legislature has been a key partner as well. It provided critical funds to help us launch our loan programs in 1987 by providing $1 million for each of our initiative foundations. And then in 1993, the legislature invested another $1 million in each of our lending programs. The legislature was there when we started, and we're asking you again to invest at this critical time in our state throughout rural Minnesota. I guarantee that rural businesses and community leaders will rise to the challenge, create quality jobs, and leverage private investment to preserve and strengthen our hometowns across greater Minnesota. Investment in businesses made against a backdrop of community development, grassroots philanthropy, will yield long-term results. I'd now like to pass the baton to Scott Marcourt, who's going to share a little bit more about the nature of our lending and the opportunities we see for business growth through increased flexible business investment capital.
Mr. Marcourt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Scott Marcourt.
Do you have any relatives in the legislature?
No, I've been asked that before, but we're connected, it's distant.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Scott Marcourt. And as Sherry indicated, we are anticipating additional companion bills for our other Initiative Foundation colleagues. I will speak broadly for the Initiative Foundations as a network, but we'll have some snippets related to our region specifically for this bill. First and foremost, it's critical for you all to know that collaboration is key to our business model. We're not in the business of competing with local private lenders or with other economic development organizations. We partner with local banks and credit unions, equity investors, and local, regional, or state economic development organizations to fill a gap or a unique niche in the marketplace and provide the additional capital needed to make a project happen. Our loan structures often involve other economic development lenders such as regional development commissions, the Minnesota Investment Fund through DEED, and local economic development groups. And we can leverage federal capital through USDA or U.S. Small Business Administration guarantees. So that's a critical piece we wanted to share with you as we think about our place in the market. Demand is really a key theme of the remarks I'd like to make today. Demand for our business financing programs is significantly increasing. From Main Street to the Industrial Park and ever in between, businesses in greater Minnesota are making investments in talent, innovation, facilities, and equipment. We are seeing significant increased demand for startup, expansion, and succession and transition projects, and also very exciting in projects that involve investment into Minnesota from another place, bringing new jobs and private capital into our state. For our 18-county region specifically, we're on track for a record fiscal year, and there's still a full quarter left in it. We have already disbursed $2.6 million in loans and transactions just these 9 months, and we have an additional $1.1 million in transactions that are approved and not yet disbursed. When you think about that, since our inception in 1986, we've disbursed 872 loans, totaling just over $38 million in direct financing. Additional capital for our business finance programs is of utmost importance to our organization. to not only address the current demand, but to help our communities remain competitive in a global marketplace. As we think about our region specifically and throughout greater Minnesota, key sectors such as manufacturing, bioscience, food and agribusiness, renewable energy, technology, and natural resources are creating clusters of innovation in our communities and regions as our business leaders are stepping up, making investments, and taking a chance on greater Minnesota. Especially promising for our regions are places where two or more of these sectors are converging. Again, in our region specifically, we're seeing growth and some pretty exciting opportunities where bioscience, ag, and manufacturing are converging together, especially where our businesses can play in a global marketplace. This increased demand is not only due to increased deal flow, but also due to an increase in project size and the size of the gaps. Financing requests of $250,000 to a half million or more are not uncommon these days, especially in manufacturing and bioscience projects that are capital intensive. Traditionally, over time, we've played the role of gap financer, but as the global economy evolves and the opportunities inside our region evolve, so does the definition of gap. We're involved in projects that have a wide variety of gaps now for us to fill: collateral shortfalls, loan to value, interest rates, terms, and a lot of other lending jargon, but it's some gaps that our businesses are facing right now, and our communities have to overcome them if we want this investment to happen. And especially interesting now is companies having gaps where they can't have to have something besides debt on their balance sheet, so they're looking at some equity solutions for the overall private project structure. A key part of our value proposition is in the types of projects we can finance. We can go beyond traditional real estate and equipment. We finance inventory and working capital to help fill the gaps unmet by economic development programs focused on hard assets. That's a key point for us to make as we think about solutions and potential uses for this capital. We offer subordinate security positions, extended loan terms, and other ways to help overcome cash flow issues for the borrower and to help bring the solution that they need. We also finance key retail and service businesses that are key to local vitality and economic diversification in our communities. Examples of that might be a community's only restaurant, only place to buy fuel, only place to buy groceries. It's a big deal if those businesses are up for sale or may close, and that's very important as we think about increased population of senior citizens, a place where you want to have an entrepreneurial climate, or a place that a family would want to live. And we're asked to step up and address those projects to keep communities vital. Our programs are grounded in strong due diligence, coupled with a focus on mission. That does make it challenging, but it makes it exciting as we think about the role that we play in the market. We greatly appreciate that this bill addresses not only business lending, but also types of financing activities. We offer innovative financing solutions, equity investments, equity-like investments, loan guarantees or participations, microloans, and other types of flexible term products that other economic development lenders and banks can't offer based upon where the companies are at. That helps us define the unique niche we play and the role that we play in regional economic development. For example, in our region in bioscience projects, a convertible note or something that looks like equity might be needed based upon where the company is. All the initiative foundations are also defined as accredited investors, so we can come in on an angel round, we can help fill out the last subscription, we can do some things that are help needed to get a project over the hump or incentivize someone to make an investment. Could go on and on about the great stories in our region, but just a couple examples to show you the types of investments we're making over time. Chandler, Minnesota, population 270. We made a couple of loans to Monogram Food Solutions. They have 320 jobs in a community of 270. Huge regional impact, huge part of our region's economy, and those are the types of projects we're asked to come to. Johnny Craft in Wabasso, Minnesota, population 650. Employs over 150 people making high-quality children's furniture and some pretty cool stuff. New Crane Manufacturing in Hutchinson, Minnesota, one of our newer loans. They're manufacturing large overhead cranes used primarily in the nuclear industry. With a global renewed emphasis on nuclear energy to reduce the release of greenhouse gases, that's going to be a huge player in the global economy. And one last story before I close, one we're really proud of in Glencoe, Minnesota. Population just over 5,000. Miromatrix Medical. It's a life science company that has a proprietary technology to decellularized organs and tissues from animal and human sources, facilitating the creation of numerous products, including the potential of fully biological transplantable human organs, doing that in Greater Minnesota. We're very proud of that and what that means to our state's economy of innovation. Finally, I'd like to talk about business succession. It's a major issue facing Greater Minnesota, and it's something that's on our board and staff's mind right now as we go forward. As more and more business owners are approaching retirement age, we must be ready with the capital and the resources to assist with succession and transition. Although economic development programs often focus on startups, expansions, or relocations, rightfully so, community leaders throughout all of the Initiative Foundation regions are very mindful of the impact of business succession, what it means if a company is sold, closes its doors, or is purchased and moved out of state. That's really a big deal. It has a major impact on the families who depend on those jobs, and there's a significant ripple effect on Main Street and the other businesses, the plumbers, the electricians, who depend on the, those companies and the buying power of those workers. In our most rural areas that may only have one or two large manufacturers, a closure or relocation could have catastrophic or detrimental effects on the economy. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. As you see in some of the material handed out today, the Initiative Foundations as a whole have invested over $227 million in just over 4,300 transactions, assisting in the retention and creation of over 43,000 jobs. And the stat we're most proud of, the leverage of nearly $1.2 billion of additional private and public capital. An investment in the Initiative Foundation will yield a measurable, demonstrable, and quick return on investment for the state, and we could put this money to use right away based on the demand and the opportunities. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Any questions or comments from the committee? Senator Westrom.
Chair, did I hear you right? The last time we got an infusion was 87, or was there a time in between there that I've missed?
I'm sorry, 1990, Mr. Chair and Senator, it was 1987 and 1993, so two different years. So it's been quite a few years since there's been an investment.
Mr. Chair, and what I understand, and we've got a similar bill with the West Central Initiative Fund, I believe, coming in. What is there just a need for more capital? Are there some loans, and I suspect there are some, that don't get paid back, and so eventually the million diminishes? Or is this to just add more opportunity and leveraging for more businesses, but the prior millions that have been allocated are still working strong with payback coming into the year fund?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, yes, we have had some write-offs over time. All the initiative foundations have. Being in the subordinate position that we are, sometimes loans don't go the direction that they are. We have the ability to be patient, but sometimes they just don't go. I would like to address your question specifically by, as we think about the types of projects that are coming forward, the sizes are getting bigger, the structures and the types of investments are different. So this capital couldn't be coming at a better time for us. It's really the flexibility of it and the ability for us to do things beyond a traditional, I'd say, old school type of term debt, term loan. There's certainly need for that in the marketplace, and we do plenty of those. That is our core business model, but we're being asked to step up and do some structures and some things that other typical economic development programs can't do. I know there's things that the state can't do, that cities and counties can't do, and that type of flexibility coupled with, frankly, just demand and size is really the issue. You know, over time, the Initiative Foundations, I don't know, Sherry, correct me if I'm wrong, have probably flirted in that 8, 9, 10% charge-off rate. Ours recently has been very close to zero. But with these new sizes, you know, one or two hits will add up fast.
Sure. Thank you.
Yep.
So is there some kind of a loan fund balance that is it a statewide balance, or is it each individual foundation has a loan fund balance, or how does that work?
Mr. Chair, since we're all independent corporations with our own audit and governance, we all have our own balance, and it is a little variable between us.
Okay, and like, what is yours, for example?
Right now, our loan portfolio size is roughly $13 million. We have about 6.5 out in loans right now, and 7 out in loans right now, and the rest in cash. But that is a bit of a deceptive number because we're required to have a loan loss reserve and a few other things. So total portfolio, approximately $13 million.
Okay. Well, we've worked closely with the Northland Foundation in my area also, and Mr. Rainier, and so I know how these things work, and I know you've done good work, and we probably don't need to have another hearing on the other four because they're basically the same presentation, but we know that there's five bills floating around for $1 million each. Isn't that the at least it's over in the House.
Yep. Mr. Chair, there were six in the House, and I would assume another five are coming. So.
Okay. Yep. All right. So, and we probably won't take the time to listen to the other five because they're going to be it's pretty much the same presentation. And,
yes.
And so, anyway, Senator Scoy.
You know, Mr. Chair, to that point, maybe somebody should offer an amendment to change the 1 to 7 and available to all the initiative funds and for the year on those hearings.
Well, and maybe we get rid of the word Southwest and just put Initiative Foundations Council. Can you?
Good idea.
Give me some more.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it.
That's if Senator Cornyn wants to carry a $6 million appropriation instead of $1 million appropriation. I'm not sure if he wants to do all that. I should probably ask him first.
Mr. Chairman. Actually, I'm a believer in these, and I think it's a good idea. And if you want to amend the bill, that's just fine with me.
That doesn't mean we have any money to give you, but at least it's sitting out there somewhere. So,
Mr. Chairman, at least the pressure then will be statewide on the committee.
There, okay, so. All right. Senator Scoy, do you want to offer that amendment then?
Mr. Chair, I would offer that amendment.
You must have something sloshing around in the bottom line of the tax bill where we can get some money from that.
No, Mr. Chair, but I was looking at the size of Senator Coonan's shoulders, and I'm pretty sure he can handle it.
Counsel, do you have a suggestion?
Well, Mr. Chair, on line 1.2, 1.5, and 1.7, would delete Southwest and insert Minnesota Initiative Foundation or Foundations. I'm not thinking Foundations. And so change also foundations on 1.3, 1.5, 1.8 to foundations. And then I think the number, Mr. Chair, was it 6 million? I think there were six regions.
Yes.
So it would be 6 million on line 1.6. And then before the period on 1.8, we could say to be equally distributed among the foundation regions or among the
individual foundations?
The individual foundations.
Six
geographic
foundation regions.
Organizations that serve the six geographic regions outside the Twin Cities area or six.
Give me the language.
Before the period, after programs, to be equally distributed among the six Minnesota Initiative Foundations.
Very good. So Senator Scoy makes that motion. Any further discussion? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we concerned about any fund balances of the rest of the regions? I mean,
we probably should be.
I don't know. I'm just wondering. But if they're asking, I'm assuming they're in the same. I think Senator Scoy's point is well taken. If they're asking, they're certainly probably in the same category or same kind of financial.
Does the department have a handle on this?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Rood?
You know, I just got an email from the Initiative Foundation, and they list the ones that they are going to be asking for, and they actually have seven. So they have Little Falls, Hutchinson, Owatonna, Fergus Falls, Bemidji, Duluth, and Little Falls. Are those all within those regions? Those are the bills that are out there right now. So.
You say Little Falls twice.
Little Falls twice.
Sure.
Sure.
That's Kazoo.
You got six.
Yeah,
six
they put
on
them
the
in twice. You're right. They did that at the beginning and the end.
Yeah,
they're trying to slip us in here. Yeah.
They want two.
They want two.
Jim.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, was your question to the fund balance? I don't have those numbers with me. My understanding from the Initiative Foundation is that most are in a similar situation, that the need is there in all the regions.
I
I can concur with, yes, Mr. Chair.
Or the need isn't there, one or the other, but anyway, we'll find out. So, all right. So, Senator Scoey makes that motion that council just mentioned about $6 million and spreading it out amongst all six foundations evenly. So, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Okay. Any further comments or questions? Senator Conan, this went way better than you expected.
You got six times.
We should come back real quick.
Ask for one,
not,
get six.
Not that I don't know where I don't How know where the $6 million is, but at least it's in the bill now. Nice. So we'll lay over Senate file number 2656 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you all very much.
Chair, it certainly helps.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee.
Mr. Chair, if there is only a million, he might have just lost 5/6 of it. Too.
Well, they'll all be happy with whatever they get. I got a funny feeling. Is Senator Marty here? Senator Marty, Senate File 2384.
Thank you,
welcome
Mr.
to the committee, Senator Marty.
Chair and members of the committee, Senate File 2384 is probably the biggest part of the bill is the budget part, which is why we're here. The bill is updating our recycling efforts in the state and asking one that more money that was being collected under the solid waste management tax would go to the counties. But I'll go through the bill quickly explaining it, and I think there are a couple of people here to testify in support of it and so on. The first part of it, the bill would be saying that we're adding, right now we're supposed to have three recyclable container materials at every public building in the state, schools, courthouses, public buildings, and we'd be adding commercial buildings in the metropolitan area, and with the amendment in a couple of years we would be adding commercial businesses in rural communities, greater Minnesota communities over 5,000, where they already are supposed to have recyclable collection stuff there. And that's section one, is just adding them. Section two is more technical than anything else. It's updating our, taking out some old dates in terms of the waste reduction goals. Section three, we're defining in recycling, we're adding source-separated compostable materials. Hennepin County, a number of the counties are moving aggressively to do this. That would count in the goal in Section 4. You'll notice that this is a slowdown of when things were to be done. The county recycling goals in Section 4 on page 3, we're deleting December 31st, 1996, which is 17 years ago, and we're extending it 17 years out into the future to 2030. For greater Minnesota, we're keeping the 35% goal we have right now. And for the metropolitan area, we'd be increasing it to 75%. And in the county folks who have been working on that, the assumption is that 15% of that would be coming from compostable materials. So for 17 years from now, the goal would be going from 50 to 60 for other things, and 15% would be coming from compostables.
Senator Marty, do you know if we've made it to 50% yet?
We have not. That's why those are 17-year-old goals. We did not meet them. We're getting close to them, but we're adding 17 more years and strengthening the goals. The rest of the bill deals with the budget portions. We'd be taking the waste management taxes and putting them all in the environmental fund. Not all of them goes there right now. And then appropriating 50% of the revenue in grants to the counties, which effectively means the counties would be getting about $20 million more for this. And you'll hear testimony from the counties on how, while this funding was supposed to go to them, I think we're now collecting about $70-75 million from the tax, and only about $12 or $13 million is going to the counties out of it. And because it was intended for them, this is our hope is that we can get some more of that money going to the counties. And that's going to be one of the big issues, obviously, for your budget, to see if we can get some help with doing that, because that was what the intent was. And then the Section 7 is one where we're asking the PCA to convene with stakeholders, including all the local governments and the waste recycling industry and so on, just to sit down and see if they can figure out, a lot of these are folks who have been doing incredible things in their own communities, figure out how we can do this in a logical manner, and then they presumably would be contacting us to figure out what changes we might need to make to help them accomplish their goals. I think one of the things we will hear from them is that, you know, they're putting a lot more of their money into it for something they thought they would be getting half the cost of those programs they thought they'd be getting from the state. And in the last 20-some years, the state's share has gone way down, which is, again, one of the purposes of the bill. And I have here, to speak to the bill briefly, we have Troy Freihammer, who is the Stearns County solid waste management person, and he's president of the Solid Waste Administrators. Also, Victoria Reinhardt, who's on the Ramsey County Board and chair, I believe, of the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board in the metro area. I think PCA is here. And we also have the St. Louis County Waste Management person, Ted Trulien, here, who can speak if you have questions. And Doug Carnival from the Waste Haulers, so he stepped aside to the other hearing room. But I think he'd be available as well. But I only have two these two that would like to testify on behalf of the counties right now.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record, and then just continue your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Victoria Reinhardt. I serve on the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, and I also serve as chair of the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board. And I really appreciate the opportunity to testify today. The Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board is a joint powers board. It was established in 1993 with the idea of, or the purpose of, increasing the efficiency and effectiveness of the region's solid waste management system, and in the process, improving Minnesota's environment. And we're very committed to that. The six counties that make up the joint powers board are Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington. Today's bill relates to the need for more SCORE funding. SCORE is the Select Committee on Recycling and the Environment that was established under Governor Perpich, so it's been around quite a while. And I think we would all agree that recycling is key. And while we appreciate every dollar that we receive from SCORE for recycling now, it is by no means adequate to the task of recycling and meeting the state's policy plan goals, which have been adopted at 60% recycling target by 2030, and of course the 15% organics recovery that was mentioned by Senator Marty. Additional state funding is needed, and there is a logical source for that funding consistent with the earlier solid waste management policy. The solid waste management tax was specifically enacted to fund recycling. Unfortunately, only a small amount of that tax collected is actually distributed to the counties for recycling programs. You will see in the handout that you have on the, I guess it's the third page, where at the top it says SWMCB County Summary of SCORE Grant Dollars, that in 2013, $70.4 million was collected. And of that, the SCORE grants were $14.3 million. I can also tell you that specifically, I know more about Ramsey County, obviously, than the other counties, but we have, in Ramsey County, we have, between the counties and the municipalities, we spend $12.2 million. Of that, we receive $1.25 million in SCORE funding, so only about 10%, and that's under the current goals. If you add the 15% organics recycling, it is anticipated that it would cost the municipalities about $3.5 million more. We put these funds in because we do understand the goal that has been set in state statute and the responsibilities that have been given to counties, and we understand the importance of the environment in Minnesota and want to achieve these goals. However, without the additional SCORE funding and the increased goals, there is really no way we're going to be able to accomplish that. We are working very hard, but it is getting more and more difficult without additional funding to do so. The SCORE funds for the coordinating board counties overall cover about 15% to 30% of the county's actual recycling and household hazardous waste management budgets. The metro counties do pass through most of those SCORE funds to the municipalities. On average, it is 76% is just passed through to the cities. With another of the remainder, the 15% is spent on household hazardous waste programs and 9% on recycling programs like yard waste. As you can see, there is a great need in order to meet those goals. Commercial recycling is also included in this legislation, and it is really necessary in order to meet those goals. Commercial recycling can represent over 50% of the recycling opportunity that exists in a county. If commercial recycling does not occur, there really is no way counties can meet the new goals. We acknowledge that the Chamber, Minnesota Chamber, has a subsidiary to work with businesses. It's called Minnesota WasteWise, and many coordinating board counties actually have them under contract to help increase business recycling. But I think even they would say that it is a very slow process when you're going one business by one business and trying to achieve this. Haulers may be supportive of a mandate, but when they are competing on the street, they have told the coordinating board that they will only offer what the businesses want in order to remain cost competitive. The coordinating board in 2013 commissioned an economic study to learn about other jurisdictions, and the economist recommended that a commercial mandate is one of the only ways to obtain higher recycling rates. Again, with 50% coming from the commercial sector, we need the recyclables in order to meet the goals. We do support single-sort recycling for businesses to minimize containers, one for recyclables and one for organics. Thank you for the additional funding and for commercial requirements. Together, they will help give counties a fighting chance for meeting the new proposed goals. Thank you very much.
Okay, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Freihammer. I work in the Environmental Services Department at Stearns County, and I'm also the president of the Solid Waste Administrators Association, or SWA, which is an affiliate of the Association of Minnesota Counties. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you regarding Senate File 2384 on behalf of both associations I mentioned. Since 1971, Minnesota Statute 400 states it is in the best interest that counties conduct solid waste management programs. How counties conduct those management programs is outlined in the Waste Management Act, Statute 115A. This may be accomplished through the reduction in waste toxicity, reduction in indiscriminate disposal of waste, as well as the recovery of materials. This is all part of the waste hierarchy, which governs all waste disposal in the state. Working with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, counties draft and adopt solid waste management plans that look at past management and potential trends to establish waste diversion goals consistent with the waste hierarchy and specific to the county. Like other counties in the state, Stearns County made the commitment and investment into its own programs, the programs of other local units of government, as well as provided assistance to private businesses to make investments in the diversion of waste from landfills to higher levels of the state waste hierarchy. Specific funding for the solid waste management came about in 1990 with the legislative package titled the Select Committee on Recycling and the Environment, or SCORE. Included in that package were block grants to counties to promote waste reduction and recycling around the state. Since 1991, those grants to counties have totaled about $14 million and have remained relatively unchanged through today. Over that same period, waste generation has trended upward, the composition of waste has changed, and the regulatory environment very different. To meet their statutory obligations, counties spent an additional $47 million for SCORE-related projects in 2012. This is 13 times greater than the 25% required match of $3.5 million. As is true with many counties, Stearns County has had to prioritize its use of the SCORE grant. New projects or waste streams have not been taken on. Grants to businesses have discontinued, and grants to other local units of government made more competitive. SWA appreciates Senator Marty for introducing this bill and is supportive of an increase to SCORE grants that will proportionally increase grants to all counties around the state. counties have and continue to work hard to meet the mandate set in statute to promote public safety, health, welfare, and the productive capacity of its population. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a couple of questions. First question is we dealt with the 50% goal for the metropolitan counties. I'm curious about the county outside the metropolitan goal of 35%. How close are we getting to reaching that? And the other question I have is when a county or a group of counties do an incinerator and they do that pre-sort where they're taking out the glass and the cardboard and the aluminum, do those pounds count into the recycling goal? Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'll answer the first part first. And yes, the upfront materials recycling facilities on a waste energy facility, though what's collected there does count towards those recycling goals. With regards to the 35%, there is quite a spread in a lot of the rural counties. I think the lowest I see is 11% recycling rate to those that are just making that 35%. There's added challenge to those counties, because of the, a lot of it is also has to do with some of the population decline, and also it could very well be some relation to not having that commercial aspect.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Marty, I think I like your bill a lot, but I am curious about the impact in Section 6, and I don't know if Mr. Mueller can help me out or maybe you can. I'm gathering that currently that 50% number is 30%, so what is the financial impact of increasing that from 30 to 50?
Mr. Chair, the 30% is going to the general fund. We'd be putting it all in the environmental, the waste management fund, in effect, and about $20 million. It would be a net cost to the state if we were to get this amount. It would be a net cost to the state of about $20 million, because that would be what would be giving to the counties.
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chairman, the third page of the handout that they had is looks like this. Actually gives a pretty good breakout of the numbers leading up to fiscal year 13. So it shows there the general fund on fiscal year 13 gets about $21.1 million. In fiscal year 15, that'll be about $22 million. So under this bill, $22 million would move over to the environmental fund. Then they would get 50% of the whole amount, which would be about $36 million for SCORE grants, which would go out in a statutory appropriation. Right now, they're getting about $14 million.
So this would be a new cost of $22 million to the general fund.
Yes, okay.
Per year.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Trilene, does anybody else want to ask any questions of these witnesses? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Marty, maybe the question directly at you. You mentioned the intent of the original law is not working. Can you expound on that a little bit for me? Is that why we're seeing the disparities in dollars here or the amount of recycling? Or what was the original intent, and why is it not working?
Mr. Chair, the only thing that wouldn't be working would be the state was hanging on to more of the money than I think was envisioned originally. And again, I think this 30% set aside to the general fund may have been very close to the beginning when it was first put in that was taken aside right away. So it's been that way forever. The counties are just saying, our costs, we're collecting more money from the fund, I think, on, I'm not sure if you have the handout that shows how much the total revenue collected from the tax from 1999 grew from about $49 million up to now about $72 million, and the grants have stayed level at about, well, they've gone up and down slightly, but between $10 and $15 million. So the revenue keeps going up, and the amount the counties are getting has stayed the same. And we're just arguing that since I think it was originally envisioned that the counties would put in half the cost of the recycling and the SCORE grants would put in the other half, and they're getting, I think in some of these cases, they're getting 10 to 15, 20% of what they're spending on it. And this was just trying to get closer to what I think the original goal of it was.
Follow-up, If I could. So the dollars that are going into the general fund, obviously some of those dollars are going to the MPCA. Do you have any idea how much that fund has grown? How much the over those same years, how much the MPCA has been getting from this?
Mr. Chair, the PCA share of it is now about $50 million. It's been growing. It was 25 16 years ago or so. So it's been growing. The state and the PCA share have been growing. The county share has been staying about the same. And
that was not the intent.
Mr. Chair, the intent of the SCORE funding was it was all going to go into waste management and waste reduction and recycling and so on. So the intent was there, and again, when the legislature at whatever time, and it may have been about the year or year or two after the SCORE grants were put in place, the SCORE program was put in place. I can't remember. It was way back then that the money was set aside for the general fund. So 70% of it is now going to MPCA or the SCORE grants, and the remainder is going to the about $20 million a year is going to the general fund. And we'd like that portion that's going to the general fund to be whatever.
Okay. Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Senator Marty, I guess I'm trying to sort of figure out where is the source of the money on this one. It looks to me that it would be something applied from on your county taxes, or can you better clarify that? Because it's not jumping out at me.
Sure. Mr. Chair, and perhaps Ms. Reinert could specify, but I think it's a tax on both residential and business garbage hauling. I think it's about 10% on residents, and you could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Osmick. This is from the solid waste tax, which is a state-imposed tax. And when it was originally set up, it was meant to do or pay for recycling at the county level, because that's what that responsibility has been put on counties to meet those goals. My understanding is that it all went into the general fund, and then it was to come back. Right now, 50% of the SCORE or the solid waste tax money that comes in goes to the PCA. And it's the other 50% that we are talking about, if that helps.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. When I have to pay this tax, where does it show up? Does it show up on my property taxes? Does it show up on my garbage bill? Where does that come from?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. My understanding is that it shows up on your garbage bill, because it is a state tax that is then turned over to the Department of Revenue and then comes through the normal tax process. If I could, though, the other portion of this, the larger portion of what happens in the recycling and at the county level, because we are putting in, well, in Ramsey County, we're putting in 90% of what is being spent on this. That is, in some cases, or in Ramsey County, it is on the garbage bill, because we also do it as a percentage of the garbage bill. But in many counties, and the way Ramsey County used to do it, is it's a line item on your property tax statement. It's probably more common.
Senator Osmond.
One final follow-up, Mr. Chair. So it comes in, it could come in perhaps in different locations. Is every county in the state enforcing this, or is it only majority from the metropolitan area? Where's the money coming from that's going into this?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, because the SCORE money is set by law, and I think it's 9.75% on residents, and that would be statewide, so every county is paying into that. And the grants are going to every county as well. Obviously, the smaller counties are getting less, but again, the formula is set right now, I guess, by PCA and
statute.
And this would be, however much additional funding we get through this, would be going to the counties under that formula.
And Senator Osmick, you weren't asking if they're increasing the tax. You're wondering.
No.
No. Okay. No. Senator Scoy.
I would like to follow up on Senator Osmick's question. I think they're very appropriate. So it's a rural county, and we in some places will have a tipping fee that is on all of our, or a charge on all of our property tax statements of $75 or $100 or whatever everybody pays. But then in addition, some of the communities and some of them have a service charge that individual residents would pay. Does the tax fall on both of those or on only one of them? Or how does that work when there's that bifurcated or whatever it is fee going on? Some of it's on your property tax statement. Some is also a residential and or commercial individual bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that does vary by county by county. Some do have a surcharge on the tip fee tax. Others will have a special assessment and a property tax.
Senator Osmick, Mr. Trulene, you got an answer to that?
I can actually answer, Senator Scoy. At the city level, what we had is you would still have this tax as part of your garbage bill, but we had on your property taxes, Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, we had a separate program that we individually had, recycling program. So you had it doubly. So SCORE went in through your garbage bill, as it's been defined to me now, but the individual programs that show up on your property tax would be individually for that particular city to pay for the cans, to pay for the actual people to come out and pick up the recycling.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Osmick, the taxes on both of them.
Yes.
And Mr. Trulene, you want to comment on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Ted Trulene, Director of St. Louis County Environmental Services Department. I came up in response to the previous question, and it is correct. Those communities that do raise some funding via their property taxes and then use that to subsidize costs, they are responsible for remitting to the Department of Revenue funds to essentially make that whole, to cover those costs. So they're not getting double billed. However, there being some portion of what they remit might come from direct fees by haulers. Some might come from the municipality, from my understanding. St. Louis County, we collect the fee at our landfill. We collect it at our any place where we provide services, plus the cities that provide collection have to remit the fee, and the commercials that provide collection have to remit the fee.
What percentage do we have in St. Louis County?
The percentage of our recycling right now in St. Louis County is a bit higher. When Mr. Freiheimer mentioned, we're closer to 60%. However, we have the benefit of having the mines, and we are able to count some of the commercial recycling coming out of the mines. Other locations where they have, say, large printing companies, they may have a higher recycling rate because they are able to count some of the recyclables that are from the printing process, too. So we're at about 60%. We receive about $488,000 for SCORE-eligible recycling costs. We share that with WLSSD, so we get to keep about $234,000. Our direct recycling and related costs this last year will be about $1.6
million. So does an increase in SCORE funding automatically mean we're going to be recycling more, or is it throwing more money at a problem that we can't increase the amount at?
We believe that the increase in money that would be coming out will allow us to expand some of our programs. We have some costs that, quite frankly, we'd like some assistance on that we're already paying. We're paying a lot more money for our programs than we're receiving. But this does not mean the counties aren't continuing to show innovation in their recycling. Just for example, in our area, we were the first region of the state to get into mattress recycling a few years ago, and we're recycling several thousand mattresses a year and getting a beneficial use out of those.
$8 a piece, right?
$8 a piece, and we're paying they're $8 a piece for the but they're going down to Goodwill and they're being deconstructed and we're getting a beneficial use from them. Mm-hmm. We just added carton recycling to our program. So now, though people that have milk cartons or the little juice cartons or the like, we can now collect those and recycle those. And we're looking at film plastics. So we're continuing to work to expand our programs. We are hoping for additional support to do that. When this bill passed back in 1989, and I'm certainly old enough to have been around for that, the amount of pass-through grant funding was $15.5 million. So we started at $15.5 million.
I think we're at about $14 million now. If you just inflate that $15.5 million out over the course of time in the last 25 years, our costs have kept going up, and we're certainly hoping for some assistance. Thank you.
Any other comments, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm trying to get my arms around this. So the state of Minnesota passed this law that the intent was really good, however, we're not carrying through with it. So now we're going to actually spend more money and make it right. My question is, how is this going to affect the rural counties, rural businesses? Also, I see the bigger sports facility things. I can understand that because there's going to be lots of recycling needs there. But I guess in section 20, page 2 and 2.4, Senator, maybe a North American industrial classification commercial building. Can you explain that to me a little bit as to what that is?
Sure.
And then there's a 5,000 population portion of the bill that I'm not clear with.
Sure. Mr. Chair, the industrial classification would be including retail, wholesale, transportation, warehousing. It'd basically be all kinds of, from arts and entertainment to food services and everyone. It'd be the traditional commercial businesses. What we'd be doing here is asking, in the metro area, we'd be doing this now. The amendment that is out there would be expanding it to other communities over 5,000 where they are required by law already to have recycling opportunities in the community. And we've had, there are some communities as small, I think in in Winona County, I think they are now actually doing curbside pickup throughout the county, not just in the cities, but throughout the county now. That's the way counties have been working at this, and again, at their own expense because the money hasn't come through. We're trying to steer the money it was intended, I'd argue, intended for them to the counties because that is the case. But these businesses are ones that, again, in a lot of these small towns, the residents are already doing curbside and drop-off and everything else, and the businesses are not required to, so we'd like to encourage them along the way because, again, as Mr. Trulene mentioned, that in St. Louis County, with certainly the bigger industrial folks are doing this. I mean, it's just too expensive to haul the waste away, and a lot of this is valuable stuff in it. So what we're trying to do is say give a couple of years and in the businesses, and these are businesses that have 2 yards of garbage a week, so there are a lot of smaller businesses that have that much garbage. We're saying they'd have to collect. We'd be changing it from not 3 containers, but they'd have to have a container to collect their recycling and dispose of it the way their customers and their employees and their and they do in their residential thing. So we'd like to expand it there. I think it's the next step, and I think a lot of businesses are already doing this and in throughout the state, but we're trying to move it forward further.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, Senator, I keep hearing you saying that the funding was not going to where it should have been going, and I'm troubled by that. I understand why counties are certainly in favor of this. They're going to get more money. But it seems like we're throwing money at something that where the intent was already there to do the job, and an awful lot of it's going back into the general fund. And I'm not quite understanding that, but thank you.
Mr. Chairman, again, if you appropriate this $20 million to the counties, that's taking money out of the general fund to do that. But again, that's what the intent of it was. It was a tax on our waste stream to recover more of the waste stream. And because the state, for budget or whatever reasons, chose to put it into the general fund instead, we're trying to say, hey, let's try and correct it 20-some years later.
Senator Osmond.
Mr. Chair, did we move the 8-2 amendment, or have we been sitting on that one?
No, we did not. I've been waiting for Senator Marty. Is this your amendment, or is it somebody else's?
Mr. Chair, that would be this amendment that when the bill was in my committee, last week, we changed it from we had had it that commercial businesses across the state were, and I talked with Mr. Quillis of the chamber and said I was willing to work with him, and he may be, Mr. Carnival's here. We changed it into just in the seven-county metro area, and we're trying to talk about what, and we've met with Mr. Quillis. I'm not sure if he's in the room right now. Yeah, he is. And he may want to speak to this. We're trying to do it in a responsible manner so we're not creating a burden to people, and we picked, and this is what we talked with him on Friday about trying to do communities over 5,000 where they're required to have recycling opportunities now, and we would suggest in 2016 then they would have to, the commercial businesses that have at least 2 yards of trash in a week would have to collect recycling as well. But and Mr. Quillis can talk about that. I don't think I describe him as highly supportive of that, but I think we're trying to come up with a reasonable time frame and so on, because again, a lot of the customers of these businesses are doing it already, and we'd like to encourage the businesses to in a couple of years.
Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and Senator Marty has portrayed it correctly. When the bill was first heard in the Environment Policy Committee, the chamber, as you can imagine, when we start mandating things upon the business community, we gives us some pause. And I pointed out, as Senator Ingebrigtsen has touched a little bit, that we're originally, as the bill was introduced, talked about commercial industrial buildings being mandated to recycle. And that's that North American Industrial Classification System, sectors 42 to 81. And as Senator Marty pointed out, that's basically everybody. It's wholesale trade, retail, transportation, banks, real estate companies, management companies, educational services, healthcare facilities, and then that dreaded all other services is Section 81. So that was my concern, Senator Marty, in working with me, originally went to just located in the metropolitan area. Friday we met and came up with the language that I'm trying to talk to some of our members about, dealing with just cities of population over 5,000. As you can imagine, Mr. Chairman, my concern was whether I was in Deer River or I was in Ten Strike, I was in Laverne, Minnesota. There was some concerns there on how we would, if we were in Elbow Lake, how we would have those commercial and industrial businesses meet this mandate. So I understand the goals that they're going through and moving those up to 75%. I'd just like to point out also in the definition there, when we talk about in the former definition of public entities on 1.20, if you go down to 1.22, the legislature is included in this previous mandate, and I'm not quite sure if I wanted to get rid of glass, plastic, or paper in this building, I could do that, and that was the other part of Senator Marty's amendment is to clarify that we don't have to have individual containers for those, that you can just have one container. But you're supposed to mandate three of those four, paper, glass, plastic, and metal. So that was my concern. Senator Marty and I will continue to have this conversation, but I was more concerned about rural Minnesota and how we would implement this on a practical matter. Senator Scalzi also informed us that she has at times moved some of her recycling in her own personal vehicle from her small business to recycling facilities in the state, Mr. Chairman. So I will keep working with Senator Marty to try and figure out how to address this mandate on businesses. I'd also like to point out to the committee, I pulled it right from the Pollution Control Agency's website, and this might have changed. It might have been updated, Mr. Chairman, but by June 30 of 2014, each state agency is to achieve a 60% goal reduction. This bill goes to 75%. So I just wanted to point out state agencies at 75% statewide. And Mr. Chairman, to address Senator Osmick, when you were talking about how much money and how that money is generated through the commercial industrial portion that we pay on our garbage bill is 17%. So 17% for businesses, 9 3/4 for residents.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Quillis, you mentioned the, what was it, 16.75%? 60 that were statin out, mandated now, and 75 we would be?
60% for state agencies. 75% is the new goal statewide.
Right, right. You don't have any idea where we are now?
The agency will probably be able to do figure those numbers a little bit more. I think statewide, I want to say 40, 50 in there. But we have just started to go through. 60% of the state was eligible to or started single sort. Now we're starting to see St. Paul's about to go on to single sort. Minneapolis has gone to it to huge success. St. Cloud's about to go in. Mankato's about to go in. So I think you're going to start to see those numbers go up as we go to single sort. I know I'm living proof of that in Woodbury. The other thing I think you're about to see is the state just got done taking public comment and closed, I think, March 14th on organics. If you look at the big pie chart on where we can go through and focus what's going in to landfills, it's 30% or so right around in there is focusing on organics. So I think that if we can more bang for the buck, if you will, start working in there, and the agency, like I said, just got done with their rulemaking and taking comments on that. And I think the industry and other folks are looking forward to that. I think you're going to see those numbers start to go up a little bit.
Senator Dietzick. Oh, Senator Marty, go ahead.
And Mr. Chairman, on that point, yes, I wanted to make it clear that 60% the agencies are supposed to hit, I think that's this summer they're supposed to hit that. These goals, the 75 and the 35% goals, are for 2030, 17 years out. Yeah. These are not what we would call, I think the counties are actually going to be able to exceed all this. My goal is not so much through having the goals, but through having them all come together, figure out what they're doing. I think what the gentleman from St. Louis County pointed out, they are working, they are making progress ahead. I think the most important thing in this bill is the fact that they've been picking up the tab for that themselves, and I think that it's our duty, and I understand the budget constraints, but our duty to try and get more funding to help them do it. But again, the 75%, we didn't change the goal in greater Minnesota. We want them in, and Mr. Chulin said they're already 60% in St. Louis County. We're trying to help them because they're doing a good job of what they're doing. And I think the funding is key to that. And again, as Mr. Kula said, I'm trying to make sure that we're doing it in a way that's not unfair to the businesses, but also recognizing that a lot of the counties, because half the waste is from commercial, that they want to have a little bit more, you know, their residential folks are doing it. Let's make sure the businesses do it. That's why we're suggesting putting it out 2 years and only in the communities where there already is, where they're already required under law to have recycling opportunities.
So, Senator Westrom, 1 second. So, Mr. Quillis, are you in favor of the A2 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, it's the Chamber of Commerce would never support a mandate, Mr. Chairman, and it will help alleviate some of our concern, and I appreciate Senator Marty has been great to work with, and we've been, and I'm sure we'll continue to have this conversation, but it's a step in the right direction, let's say that.
Better than what's in the bill. Okay. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I guess I've got similar concerns, but I also know what happens to our towns under 5,000 after we get it into statute for towns above 5,000, and I guess, Senator Marty, if I can just ask you, 75% metro, what's the next step after that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, of that 75%, it's 60% other than compostable. I mean, the bill was originally worded 60 plus 15, but was worded awkwardly, and the folks who were working on it in the House, when we suggest it was awkwardly worded, they said, why don't you just have the goal of 75%, including the compostable. And as Mr. Quillis said, that's a huge gain. And I think the reality is we're moving forward. The counties, every one of them has a different set of challenges. Those that have the waste, the burning facilities and so on, are, because they're working across multi-county lines, tend to have more developed programs. again, some of them, I think I mentioned earlier, Winona County now is curbside, I believe, countywide. I think the trend is happening here. They're trying to, I think the counties want to, they've been working on it, they want to continue working on it. They very much would like to have funding, and I think it's a fairness thing that that's what it was intended for. I'd love to have us move that way.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, I didn't quite get the answer. What's the next step? So we get to 2030. Is the next step 92.5%, and then we go to 100%, or what's the next step above 75?
Mr. Chair, I'm guessing in the metro area, I don't have a crystal ball, but I have a feeling they will have exceeded 75% before that time. I think the goal is to have a sustainable waste stream where we can recover materials that are going through. I mean, it's a finite amount of resources, and we're trying to recover as much as we can in a sustainable way. I think that's a good goal, and I think, I think if we had, I think the counties are all working on the same thing. They understand the more we can get out of landfills, the more we can reuse products, recover products through recycling, the better off we are. So there, I would tell you, I think the counties, even without goals, we keep pushing forward on this.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, I mean, is the goal then 100%? I mean, we basically could eliminate the trash truck? Is that?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that we're going to eliminate the trash trucks, but more and more of the trash trucks are picking up stuff that's recovered, recyclable material, and so on.
Okay. So, Senator Marty, what about the areas that do incinerate? Is that viewed as a good way to go to not expand landfills unnecessarily and make ashes out of it rather than piling it up?
Mr. Chair, the land in the state recycling or reproduct waste management hierarchy, which has been in law for many years, the burners are above landfills. I think that may even be moving out in Coochachin County, I believe. They're working on a project right now that would sort of gasification. I'm not the expert in this, but they're through some complex, very high voltage electronic system. They're taking the stuff and heating it up very hot and getting biofuel gases out of it for burning. And recovering metals and other things through along the way. I think we're going to continue to seeing this. I don't know what the technologies are going to be in 10, 15 years from now, and this goal is actually 17 years out, so it's a long way out, but I think the bottom line is we're not going to have trash dealt with in the way we do now. It may be the same companies, it may be the same things happening, but it's going to be different processes for dealing with it and recovering much, much more of it.
Senator Sloy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Marty, with regard to the composting, you must not be figuring that the individual composting is significant enough to worry about, because I don't know how you would measure my mother-in-law's composting in the backyard. I mean, she's already removed it from the waste stream, but I suppose that's just such a small amount that you don't count it, or how does that figure into this?
Mr. Chair, maybe I should have one of the folks from one of the rural counties comment on that, but it is a significant amount, and in much of greater Minnesota, it's already farmers just they're dumping their compost outside. I mean, I'm not sure how they count it in the measurement, and maybe one of the rural county folks could speak to that.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I was actually thinking of she lived in South Minneapolis. I mean, this could happen in the rural areas too. I mean, it's just that you have no way of calculating that because it's never in the waste stream at all. It's just in the backyard.
And Mr. Chair, I'm not the expert in how this is all counted, but again, the goals have been to reduce the amount that goes into the waste stream and to recover as much of what goes in the waste stream. And maybe one of these two gentlemen can help clarify it.
Who can help?
We
composted
our house too. I mean,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Ted Treline. Senator, we actively encourage backyard composting in St. Louis County. We give diagrams on how to build backyard compost bins. We also subsidize the purchase of backyard compost bins for residents so that if a bin costs $60, we will purchase it, provide it to the resident for $15. I think we've gotten 4,000 or 5,000 bins out here in the last 9 years, which is starting to get to a good measurable percentage of our population. As far as measurement, I think it's a good, I think it's a very good point. Certainly, how much is coming out of that? Well, some of it's going to depend on how actively people compost and what they're doing. We're looking at it as a way of reducing the amount of material that's going to the landfill and getting a beneficial use out of it. So if we're not doing as good a job of quantifying that, I think we're less concerned about that. So I believe the state may have some numbers that allow us to project from that, but I'm not close enough to have an answer, perhaps, Carl.
Good afternoon. Carl Michaud, Director of Environmental Services for Hennepin County. And similarly, the Hennepin County has provided compost containers for residents for backyard composting. And it's actually very easy to measure. In the city of Minneapolis, they measure all of the trash that's being collected. And by the institution or by implementing the backyard composting, they could track and see how much waste has been reduced over time on their collection routes. So it's an easy way for the city to actually document how much organic material was composted.
Okay. Senator Osmond, did you want to move the 82 amendment?
Oh, sure, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Marty, you want this on the bill, right?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate it. The bill ends up in your committee.
Mr. Carnival, do you want to say something first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a problem changing the bill to include cities with population 5,000 or more. The previous bill, as I understand right now, includes the metro area. Just because a community out in greater Minnesota is at 5,000 or more doesn't mean that they have any greater opportunities in terms of recycling outlets and that type of thing, makes it any easier for them. And we have, quite frankly, in my community, we already have a number of people that voluntarily do quite a bit of recycling, and some do just as Senator Scalzi does, haul it themselves. And I think, quite frankly, the cost of getting rid of solid waste these days has gotten to a point where it behooves them to do that. You know, we always talk about encouraging, which is just a legislative way of saying, I'm going to put another mandate on you. I'm all in favor of getting the counties some additional money because, in typical state fashion, we've put impositions on them and then haven't carried through with the money. But I really have difficulties with the language of bringing this back to a population of 5,000 or more. And with that in there, I would, quite frankly, I feel strongly enough about it, I would vote against the bill in its entirety at this point.
Okay. Mr. Carnival.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to belabor the point very much more, but Doug Carnival, representing the National Waste and Recycling Association, formerly the National Solid Waste Management Association. And to answer your question first, we're neutral on the bill, but we do agree with the spirit of the bill. The private sector in the recycling industry has been very much at the forefront of developing and recycling in the state of Minnesota. As a matter of fact, we've been very innovative and involved over the years, pioneering things like single-sort recycling throughout the state. As Mr. Quillis mentioned, 60% of the state is now covered by single-sort recycling, and as he also mentioned, the city of St. Paul will be implementing that soon. Minneapolis has implemented single sort and experienced a 60% growth in its recycling program because of that one factor, and we're delighted to see that. So we're in favor of increased recycling. We've made many innovations and investments over the years in recycling, and we'll continue to do that. We support many of the provisions of the bill, but not all. We're in favor of the source-separated reduction goal that's in the bill. We support the idea of redefining recycling to include source-separated compostables. We do support the idea of requiring commercial recycling, obviously a bit self-serving since we're in the recycling business. And we strongly support the idea of redirecting money out of the general fund into the environment fund, where much of it should have gone in the first place. for fear of confusing you more than you've already been confused. I was around during the time when a lot of this was passed back in the 80s and 90s, and if I could briefly tell you my recollection, originally there was a sales tax on waste collection. There was also a solid waste fee that was collected on waste collection. That was expressed in dollars or cents per cubic yard, which was very difficult to understand. So in the late 80s, those two taxes were combined into something called the solid waste tax, which was about 13%, if my recollection serves me right. It was the sales tax plus the other fee, and they combined them at about 13%. Then in the early 90s or mid-90s, we had to clean up a lot of old closed landfills. The state took over those landfills and had to figure out a way to pay for all those, and the business community was willing to accept an increase in the solid waste tax to fund the cleanup of those landfills over the years, and that bumped it up to 17%, has been referred to along the way here. So currently the solid waste tax at the state level is 17% for commercial and 9.75% for residential. Unfortunately, at the time that law was passed in the mid-90s, there was also a provision that said we really didn't know how much it was going to cost, but if we collected a certain amount of money from that tax that was over a certain amount, it would be readjusted downward. Well, it didn't quite hit the mark, and the readjustment didn't occur, but the fee continues to increase as the money comes in from that solid waste tax, which is what's generating more money into the solid waste fund as well as into the general fund. So that's part of the history. You should also know that in addition to that 17.5% and 9.75%, the counties levy taxes or fees on top of that. And I believe, don't quote me, but my recollection in one of the metro counties, it's either approaching 50% or is it 50%. So the total tax on your waste collection at the commercial sector is about 50%, at least in one of the counties. And I know my county friends will jump all over me. My recollection is it's quite high, as you might imagine. So the only thing we are ambivalent about or have concerns about in the bill have to do with the recycling goals, which we think, as has been mentioned, are quite ambitious and maybe difficult to reach in the time between now and 2030. But certainly the private sector will do their best to work with all of the constituents here to try and get to those goals as we move forward. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carnival. So why don't you try answering my question from earlier? If we throw more money at the problem, will we automatically get more recycling?
Well, Mr. Chair, I hope so. Obviously, the money's not going to the private sector, so it's not the clients that I represent. But we've worked with the counties over the years, and we're confident that the money will be well spent. And in conjunction with the efforts of the private sector, we're hoping the recycling will increase.
Senator Marty.
And Mr. Chair, on your question as well, I will say that recycling is going up and they are spending more money on it, but they're spending their own because they haven't been getting as much of the SCORE funding, which is, again, why the point of the bill. But.
Okay. To the 8-2 amendment, Senator Westrom, you have questions before we go?
Mr. Chair, I guess could you give me clarification here? So the current bill applies to just the metro counties, as I understand, Senator Marty, and this is limiting it to the whole state, but towns of that are 5,000 or more.
Mr. Chair, the bill as it came in was covering all commercial businesses with over 2 yards statewide. In the last committee, I suggested as a placeholder we put it in just in the metro area, and then in the conversations since last week during the committee hearing, meeting with the chamber and meeting with the counties and everybody else, we were proposing this thing that communities over 5,000, where they are required to have at least the county recycling center or the drop-off point in each city, over 5,000. In other words, that since the residential folks have that the commercial folks, we would be asking them to do so as well 2 years from now. Again, a lot of communities smaller than 5,000 are going to curbside. I think a lot won't be right away because especially in some of the sparsely populated counties, it just you're not going to have that everywhere. But a lot of towns as small as 1,000 or so are going to curbside. We just thought $5,000 was a reasonable thing. And we also are changing in the amendment from having multiple containers reflecting the reality nowadays is that they're often doing single sort, which I think is a huge gain in terms of the amount that's being recovered. I think one of the witnesses just said Minneapolis went up 60% when they went to single sort. And I think that's the trend, which is why the language clarifies that you can have one container for recyclables, not three or more.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, if we pass this amendment, we expand the bill to statewide again, but communities over 5,000. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And if we don't pass this amendment, we leave it limited to the metro counties.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, one more question, Senator Marty, in the full spirit of the bill. So every commercial building business in our let's assuming it's not limited to 5,000 or more, but either way, what can you just state what will it our commercial businesses will have to do? So our downtown restaurants, our drugstore or pharmacy, our small town bank, our State Farm Insurance Agent Office, our small town car dealer, all these commercial businesses, what will they have to do assuming this bill passes and they were covered by it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, if they have 2 yards or more of trash per week, a small accounting firm isn't going to, but if they're in an office building or a strip mall or something else, it would be by the building. In other words, if a building has more than 2 yards of things, that strip mall or office building would have to have a container for collecting recycling. And if it's in a town where there's curbside, I'll guarantee you Mr. Carnival's haulers would love to have that business and so on. If it doesn't have curbside, any community over 5,000 has to have a drop-off point there for residential and commercial industrial. And so they'd have to haul it to that entity. Again, that would be only buildings that have more than 2 yards a week of trash, which is not going to be your small. I mean, some small restaurants may, some won't have that much recycling, but it would require some of them to have a bin for recyclables and to take that in.
So, Mr. Chair, two follow-ups to that. What about apartment buildings, small or big, and what happens no matter who the entity is? Christmas week can get you more trash than the week after. Are we talking? We're going to have garbage police measuring the high point or the high water mark, like we've got the DNR out measuring high water marks.
Mr.
So
Chair,
if you're over 2 yards, or if you can prove you've averaged less than 2 yards, it doesn't apply to you.
Mr. Chair, we're not going to have garbage police out there. I don't want to. The main thing that we're going to accomplish with this bill is if we can get some funding for the counties, it'll help. I will tell you, I think the counties are moving there. I'm not saying this amendment is the most important thing in it, because I think realistically the counties and the businesses are going to be moving that way. I think a lot of communities, Winona County, their latest report showed overwhelming public support for their countywide curbside program, businesses and individuals. I think it's happening that way, so this amendment is not make or break the bill. The thing that I think is most important is the counties. I think they deserve more of the funding. It was intended more of it to go to them, and I'm hoping we can do that. This amendment, I'd like to have it, but it's not the biggest part of the bill.
Mr. Chair, just in conclusion on the amendment, I guess I would feel more comfortable, still uncertain on the bill, but I think it's better left. Let's try it in the metro area and leave the amendment off at this point, I would suggest.
Chair, that's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to some of the questions, I'm just assuming, and maybe somebody could correct me if I'm wrong, Senator Marty, some of the outstate cities that are over 5,000 may want this, simply because I'm assuming that if you say you're recycling 6 cubic yards, I mean, say your trash is 6 cubic yards, and you can recycle some of that,
your trash bill would be lowered because now you're recycling what you were formerly paying for putting in your trash container. So I'm thinking that you might want to check with your local businesses because, say, in a town like Bemidji, I mean, that's a huge town. Some of those businesses could really, in my mind, save money if they're recycling and lowering their trash quantity.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, to that point specifically, Senator Scalzi, I mean, if it's of a benefit to them, they will. And quite frankly, the counties have the authority to impose certain requirements for their waste stream and how it's handled as well. And we shouldn't forget that they also have a role to play in this. But what my first comment was, or what my first point for asking for recognition was, is that I would move to amend the amendment by striking sentences 1.3 and 1.4.
What is the amendment? Well, not quite, I guess.
Do we need 1.2 also? You want to strike 1.2 also then, Senator?
Yes, okay.
Okay. All right. Senator Scoia, do you want to comment first or no?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm curious about the impact of what's going on since the city of Bemidji came up, because Beltrami County has an arrangement with the Seven County Joint Powers Board for incinerating. Much of the recycling that's done at that level is done pre-sort, which I hear counts. So I'm not exactly sure what the impact would be of this on the city of Bemidji, but from my perspective, I think the author has been working well with the stakeholders. I generally would be supportive of the author, as I can tell he's working to try to find resolution. It appears to me, Mr. Chair, that with or without the Weber amendment, there will be some ongoing discussions about this bill before it would be able to pass out of this committee. But for today, I'm going to be supportive of the Senate author.
And I should point out to members that, the bill itself almost doubles the target of what we have in this committee for money. So we're going to have to lead over for possible inclusion. But let's go through this exercise of voting on Senator Weber's amendment. And so he's basically taking out the part about.
Mr. Chair, I have a question on that striking.
Yes.
This would probably be to Mr. Knopf. By striking 113 and 114, aren't you opening that up to everybody in every city in the state of Minnesota? Because it's not defining metropolitan area. It's not defining the size of the city. You're opening this up to the entire state now.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmek, the metropolitan area is defined in Chapter 115. And do you have the? And so when we were in the Environment Committee, because that was defined within the chapter, that's why it's just stated as metropolitan area. And I believe it's the seven county metro area with that definition in Chapter 115.
But Mr. Chair, and to that point, but taking out 113 and 114, does that not just take the whole metropolitan definition out? Or
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmek, it keeps in the owner of a commercial building located in the metropolitan area. This amendment was just going to add, and then in 2016, it would also be expanded to cities with larger than 5,000 population.
On the Weber amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. On the A2 amendment, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Chair is in doubt. All those in favor, raise your hand. All opposed? Motion prevails. We had a very good discussion. And so what we're going to do is we're going to lay 2384 over as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And like I said, we're a little short on money, so
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very aware of the budget issues, but thank you for your consideration.
Okay, thank you very much, Senator Marty. Senator Saxhawk.
That's why we got him on this end. That's why we got the roaring lion on this end.
Senator Saxhawk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today I'm presenting Senate File 2598. This bill is a one-time appropriation of $500,000 from the General Fund to the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development to be used for grants to small business development centers. With me today are Mike Ryan, Director of Twin Cities Small Business Development Center, University of St. Thomas, and Kim Babine, Director of Governmental Affairs, DEED, to explain the bill in more detail and answer any questions the committee might have.
Mr. Ryan, you want to go first? Or Kim, who's going first?
Should I go first?
I'll go.
Okay, then say your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, I'm Kim Babine. I'm Director of Government Affairs at DEED. And thank you for having us today. I'm pleased to be here to discuss our Small Business Development Center program. DEED operates the lead center for the SBDC network. We do not provide direct services, but manage the program for the state on behalf of the Small Business Administration. We're supportive of this program. It's not a governor's request, but we're happy to talk about the program here. The SBDCs began in 1977 as a program of the Small Business Administration. Today, there are 63 centers across the U.S. that operate more than 1,000 satellite offices to make the program accessible to entrepreneurs and small businesses. State governments contribute to the SBDC budgets in nearly every state across the country, and some provide the total amount of match required. We in Minnesota appreciate and recognize the strong local public and private partnership with the SBA, state government, colleges, and universities. The Small Business Development Centers provide one-on-one business consulting services, training to entrepreneurs and small businesses on everything from planning to bookkeeping to effective management to social media and much more. Loan packaging assistance to help entrepreneurs find the capital they need. Minnesota has 9 regional centers hosted by institutions of higher education. Each of the 9 centers have satellite or outreach offices in 32 additional locations for 2014, so there are 42 touch points around the state. The total annual budget for this program is around $3.6 million. 50% of that is a required match. The match is split between cash and waived indirect in-kind donations. The majority of match funding comes from the 9 regional hosts. In recent years, particularly since 2008, budgets have been reduced across the board, and some host institutions...
Can you go back?
I'm sorry.
Where's the $3.6 million come from?
That is the total annual budget
of
the SBDC network.
Okay, not the amount that we're putting in.
Correct.
Okay, all right.
The bill calls for $500,000.
But I think in last year's budget we had a total of $678,000, so you're not talking about that either, right?
No. This is the total that, Mr. Chair, members, the entire network is 3.6, and the state provides some funding towards that 3.6.
Okay. Currently, it's a competitive grant?
No. This is not the competitive grant. We provide DEED out of our general operating budget, provides the host and, let me see, not seeing it right here because... but we provide some of our general operating funds that then funds the state lead center as well as provides assistance to some of the other centers.
But the $678,000 that was in the budget last year, that's in the competitive grant program, right?
If that is the Business Technical Assistance Competitive Grant Program, that's separate than this program, both providing technical assistance to small businesses.
All right, go ahead.
All right. We were talking about the budgets being cut in recent years for these small centers, or for the centers out in Greater Minnesota. And one host in Bemidji State University has opted out of the program due to budget constraints at the end of 2001, and so the Northwest region is now being served only by the Duluth Center in addition to Duluth serving Northeast. The SBDCs are part of Minnesota's economic infrastructure and are very engaged in economic development, particularly in Greater Minnesota. Beyond the direct technical assistance, the centers are connected to a variety of other services that are important to serve clients. And finally, the centers provide much-needed technical assistance to entrepreneurs and existing small businesses at critical stages to help them start, grow, and expand. And, Mr. Chair, we have Mike Ryan here from the Minneapolis Center.
Welcome, Mr. Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mike Ryan, and I'm the director of the Twin Cities Metro Small Business Development Center at the University of St. Thomas. And I'm here representing the 9 regional centers across the state, and we are strongly in favor of this bill. Our goal at the Small Business Development Center is to help businesses grow, succeed, pay taxes, and then hire more people who also pay taxes. Kim didn't share some of the numbers. I would like to share a few numbers with you to give you the scope of the program. Across the state, our 9 small business development centers served over 3,000 businesses last year. My center at the University of St. Thomas, 395 businesses. We helped our clients access $116 million in capital in 2013, and we helped 205 businesses begin. Those numbers would indicate it's a pretty good program, but our resources are always stretched. I can tell you at my center at the University of St. Thomas, we turn away more businesses than we serve. And we turn away because it's just not a wise expenditure of money, but many we turn away because we don't have the hours, we don't have the resources to support that business. That's why this bill is so important. Today, we're coming out of a recession, and our core competencies at the Small Business Development Center are developing marketing strategies and providing access to capital. Our clients are growing. We're seeing good trends in the community, but we are stretched. So this additional funding of $50,000 per center would go directly into client services. I'm sure I'm not the first person to sit here and ask for money. This is nothing new, I'm sure. But you may ask why the Small Business Development Center is the best place to invest this money. A couple of reasons. Number one, we're already in place. We have our infrastructure, we have our people, we have the talents, we have the experience, and we can put this money directly into the field immediately. Secondly, we have demonstrated over the years, and I've been with St. Thomas for 13 years, we have the capability to very quickly and efficiently deploy these resources. I'll point to a couple of examples. The Department of Commerce came to us about 10 years ago because of the unemployment, and they asked us to do something called Project GATE. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it stands for Growing America Through Entrepreneurship. We ran that pilot program through the metro here. It was very successful. They came back 7 or 8 years later and asked us to do it again. So we have a history of being able to move on these initiatives pretty quickly. Also, we just came out of a program out of the 2010 Small Business Jobs Act, sort of a turnaround program for businesses in distress. We're still compiling the numbers on that, but it looks pretty successful. And that those are initiatives that come out, they're funded, we get on them, and we work, spend a year or two and get these things turned around. What would we do with the money? It kind of varies by region. We have 9 regions. Everyone looks a little bit different. Firstly, I think we would all, my counterparts, we all would kind of beef up our internal capabilities, our hours, our staffing, the folks who have the skills that get the job done. But we also have very close ties with the economic development organizations across the state and other nonprofit service providers. And I suspect many of us would enter partnerships for special initiatives with veterans, perhaps minorities. I know here in the Twin Cities, we partner with MITA to help with ethnic minority-owned businesses. I run a number of veterans events, being a veteran myself, for the returning vets who are thinking of starting a business. I'm starting to partner with Women Venture on some women-owned business initiatives. Just in conclusion, I just want to give you a short story. And this is not unusual. This happens in the metro, but it's across the state, and there are hundreds of stories like this. There's a small business north of Minneapolis called Simplex Construction. It's a woman-owned business. The woman's name is Sarah Basie. And it's a very successful, very profitable business with about 10 employees. And Sarah, this was a quote from Sarah. She said, "The SBDC laid the foundation and put the structure in place that the company became. I think it would have been a completely different experience without the help. Who knows how much time, energy, and money might have been spent trying to get to the same place, if you ever could get there." So I hope that we can demonstrate or have demonstrated that we're a very efficient place to put our dollars to work to help the Minnesota economy, and this bill would be a great help. Mr. Chair and members, thanks for your time.
Any comments, questions? Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're talking literally about $50,000 per center. Is that what it comes out to about?
Mr. Chair, yes, we are $50,000 per center.
And do you have federal money coming in, too?
Mr. Chair, we as a state, I believe, have about $1.7 million in SBA federal funding that's spread across the nine regions.
Okay. And you're getting that. They haven't turned the spigot off, right?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
So you're receiving that money. It's not that the federal government is... eliminated that.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We're receiving that money.
Mr. Chair, it's important to note that 1.7 from the federal government has to be matched one-to-one, $1 to $1, by local non-federal funds. So that's part of what the appropriation, the $50,000 to each center would help, because some of the regions and centers out in greater Minnesota in particular are having some trouble in reaching that match in fundraising. They go to banks and other institutions to raise that federal match, and money's tight, and they're having trouble being able to do that. So getting the match will help ensure that they're able to will help ensure that we pull down all the federal money that we can, and also free folks up in those centers to be able to provide more direct service technical assistance.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Saxog, then we'll lay over 2598 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair,
thank
members.
You. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxog, and thank you. Good presentation.
Thank you.
We got
thank
next. You. Senator Dietzick. Those are the popular numbers today. Senate file 2676. Senator Dietzick.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomasoni and members of the committee. Earlier this month, DEED was before us discussing their budget and the implementation of the state's Olmstead Plan. The Olmstead Plan is from a United States Supreme Court decision. The court ruled that Americans with Disabilities Act requires states to provide services to people with disabilities in the most integrated settings appropriate to their need. Every state must have a plan, and it's called the Olmstead Plan. And this plan includes helping people find jobs. The purpose of Senate File 2676 is to better assist people with disabilities who wish to be part of the Minnesota workforce. It increases provider funding and strengthens the state's extended employment basic program known as EE Basic. Members, there are a number of reasons why this is a good bill. I will give you three of the top reasons. There are a number of underserved and unserved people with disabilities who wish to work but are not receiving the necessary extended employment services. EE Basic provider rates have not kept up with the rate of inflation, and they are falling behind. As a result, providers have struggled to keep people with disabilities working in the community and in community-based employment. And last, just as the department is asking for additional funds to implement the Olmstead Plan, providers need the money to fortify EE Basic programs as they prepare for the changes in the plan. These programs are important to so many people. My cousin participates in one of these programs. Her program gives her a reason to get up every day. It makes her feel like a contributing member of society. Everyone wants to feel they are doing their part to pay their own way and make society better. With me today to give you more details on the bill and the EE Basic program is Ms. Heather Erickson from Task Unlimited and Mr. Willie Brown, who is a client of Task Unlimited. Ms. Kim Peck from DEED is also here to answer any questions on the EE Basic program. Thank you for your time, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. My name is Heather Erickson, and I'm the Residential Program Director at TASS Unlimited. Mr. Chair, on behalf of the Minnesota Organization for Habilitation and Rehabilitation, also known as MOAR, I want to thank you for your past support of championing the workforce needs of people with disabilities, and I appreciate Senator Dietzick taking the lead on such a vital need this session. I'm here today to ask for your support for Senate File 2676. MOAR is a collection of organizations across the state which provide human services and vocational rehab services to people with disabilities. In front of you is a handout from MOAR, and on the back side you'll see that some of our EE providers or extended employment providers are in your Senate districts. Some of our other MOAR agencies pushing for the well-known 5% campaign funding increase in human services are also located in the Senate districts of Senator Tomasoni, Senator Rood, Senator Scalzi, and Senator Westrum. As you may know, EE Basic programs are outcome-based training, job placement, and job support programs for Minnesotans with disabilities. Providers are reimbursed by DEED for these services only after they've been performed. That's one reason why EE providers have a proven success in securing employment, income, and advancement for this critical segment of the state's workforce. Unfortunately, the current EE Basic rate doesn't meet the full cost to provide EE services. Contracts are capped, so EE providers must put in additional funds before the end of the fiscal year. This has led to a weakening of the EE system, reducing access to individuals and potential private sector employers willing to hire people with disabilities. This situation contributes to the fact that people with disabilities have a nearly 50% lower rate of participation in the workforce and a 5% higher unemployment rate than people without disabilities. This employment gap threatens an individual's ability to provide for themselves. It drains on current and future state resources and prevents employers from tapping into a rich pool of employees to meet job growth and future vacancies caused by senior citizen retirements. And, as Senator Dietzick put so well, members of MOAR are very concerned that the Olmstead decision and upcoming EE rule changes will add further burden on the EE provider system without the adequate finances. As an increase to the EE provider rate won't completely address the Olmstead changes, but it will better stabilize the EE system for the impact of this change. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to illustrate the importance of the basic EE program and to show how we can collectively make a difference for the better, Mr. Willie Brown has a few words to say.
Hello. My name is Willie Brown. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for letting me speak here today. I'm here to talk about TASK Unlimited and my story. TASK Unlimited has helped many people with mental illness to have supported employment and housing. I was incarcerated from December 2008 to March 2009 for Class A1 felony. At the time of the incident, my mental illness was not stable. I did not have a job, and I did not have stable housing. I was not on the correct medications, and my symptoms were increased. I couldn't focus, couldn't go about my daily activities, and was having hallucinations. My mental health was getting to the point I was so depressed, I couldn't sleep. I would stay up for days at a time. I couldn't eat, and I was afraid others would harm me. In November of 2009, I was referred to TASK Unlimited. I was accepted into TASK Unlimited Work and Housing Training Program on November 9, 2009. The staff accepted me with open arms and opened their doors for me. Training was really tough at first, and sometimes I thought about quitting, but I didn't quit. It was through TASK Unlimited that I got the support that I needed for my mental illness and was able to start working in the community. There was staff always available for support, steady housing, and a job that made me feel good about myself. At TASK Unlimited, I learned about a lot of skills to cope with my mental illness so that I could have a relationship so I can have relationships again, work every day, and earn my own money. I graduated from the training program in May 2010 and moved into task longer-term supported housing. From there, I moved into independent housing on February 1st, 2013 with my fiancé, Virginia, who is here with me today. I wouldn't be able to do any of that if I didn't have a job at TASC where I can work and also get support for my mental illness. I've been in TASC Unlimited Programming for 4 years now, and I haven't been hospitalized, have stayed out of legal trouble, and have maintained my job thanks to the employment support I have. I am also vice president of the Interlocking Board of Directors at TASC, and we meet every 3 months, and I have also speak to other clients in training. My son, dad, and I have a close relationship where previously we did not. I told my son I was going to speak in front of the Senate, and he told me he was proud of me, and that made me feel proud. I have come a long way since 4 years ago, and being able to work has been a huge part of that. I would like to see more programs like TASC Unlimited for people with mental illness to be able to work. It's hard to find stable housing and jobs when you have a record along with the mental illness. I would like to see TASC Unlimited programming continue. Again, I've come a long ways, and working through TASC Unlimited was a stepping stone to my success. Thank you for listening to my story.
Thank you very much. Very good testimony. Appreciate that.
Thank you, sir.
Senator.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Deason, I really appreciate that you included me as a co-author of this bill. And I just want to say, you have my support and encouragement.
Thank you.
Yep. And but I wonder if anyone from Moore is here. I wonder. Oh, so you are. Okay. I don't want to be I'm usually not picky in detail, but on your flyer, I'm just, wanting the part about ethnically, racially, it's missing out the Southeast Asian component. So,
missing the what? I'm sorry.
On your flyer.
Yeah.
Maybe we can talk about it later, so.
Okay.
Yeah. I just want to.
Sure. Absolutely.
Make some fix on your flyer. And yep, the bill is good. Not
I notice I'm an author too, so it must be really good. Okay. So, but Senator Dietziger, or maybe Ms. Erickson, this specifically addresses persons with severe disabilities, right? And the current EE program does not? Is that how?
The current EE program does, but what we're asking for is an increase to that funding because we haven't been able to stretch it for an entire fiscal year thus far.
Okay. All right. Okay. Any other comments or questions? No? Okay. All right, then seeing none, then thank you very much, and we'll lay over Senate File 2676 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Senator Dibble, Centers for Independent Living. Senate File 2640. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 2640 seeks support for the Minnesota Centers for Independent Living. Mr. Chair and members, we've had some presentations from the Centers for Independent Living here in this committee in the past. And, of course, the SILs, as we refer to them, very much appreciate the funding that's been provided through this committee in the past. The funding, and we'll have Ms. Ruff go into some of the funding history, it's been tough in recent years with some cuts when things were grim around here. And since that time, funding has remained fairly flat. The point I want to emphasize is that Centers for Independent Living, the money we put in, can show a fairly direct return, particularly in those arenas where they provide services to transition folks out of nursing home and other forms of institutional care, provide folks with the kinds of services and support, both
direct supports as well as referrals and other kinds of community supports to allow them to live, as their titles would suggest, more independently out in the community in their homes. Just by way as a quick reminder, and I'm referring to this handout that you have in your packet, and I'm looking on page number 6, and you can see for yourself the kinds of services that the SILS provide across the state. Advocacy, independent living skills, information and referral, peer counseling, helping with some of those direct kinds of services, home modifications, like I said, nursing home relocation, PCA, some focused supports for veterans, transitions for youth with disabilities, a linkage line. And Mr. Chair and members, on page 4, you can see some of the fiscal history in the chart there, where things have remained essentially flat over recent years, which of course means that, you know, against inflation and the increasing level of demand, the SILS have lost significant ground. I'm grateful that managed to kind of hold steady, but the need is great. The SILS are, you can see on the map in front, SILS are statewide, and so this is a request on behalf of all the SILS across the state. With that, I have Kara?
Yes.
Kara Ruff from the Minnesota SILS, who can provide a little bit more detail about this particular request.
Welcome, Ms. Ruff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Kara Ruff. I'm the Executive Director of Independent Lifestyles, the Center for Independent Living in Sauk Rapids, St. Cloud area. We cover the 9-plus county region of central Minnesota. As Senator Dibble spoke, there is a map on the front, and that it shows the service areas for the 8 centers for independent living in Minnesota. And so that the 8 centers for independent living in Minnesota comprise MASL, which is the Minnesota Association of Centers for Independent Living. And it's on behalf of MASL, all 8 centers, that we are requesting the increase for funding in Senate File 2640. Centers for Independent Living are private, nonprofit, community-based organizations. And the reason I've chosen to spend the last 23 years of my career in this environment is because I can tell you it works. Going into the nonprofit sector, I wanted to make a difference in people's lives. And I can tell you without fail that the Centers for Independent Living are a unique environment that is not duplicated elsewhere. Being consumer-controlled, we have to have at least 51% of our board and our staff also be people with disabilities so that we're truly governed by those that we serve. We are not residential. We cover large service regions throughout the state. And most uniquely, we cover all disabilities. So anyone with a physical, cognitive, mental, chemical, sensory, severe, mild, everything in between, any type of disability is eligible for our services. We also serve individuals from birth to death. So we're a one-stop shop. People don't have to run around from entity to entity or organization to organization to get their needs met and their services provided. They can come to a CIL and have all of those needs met under one roof. All of our services are designed to prevent out-of-home placement and provide opportunities for living and participating fully in the community. In federal fiscal year 13, we collectively serve 72,000 individuals with disabilities, providing them with transitional services, nursing home relocation, independent living skills training, accessibility and ramp projects, services to disabled veterans, peer mentoring, advocacy, information and referral, social and support services. We also have a very unique and successful collaboration currently with Rehabilitation Services, in which we are working side by side with the Voc Rehab Counselors to ensure that people with disabilities have the skills they need to become successfully employed. Our request is comes from the Statewide Independent Living Council, who controls the Statewide Independent Living Plan. And their recommendation for many years has been that the 8 centers have a minimum funding level in state and federal dollars of $500,000 per CIL. Senator Dibble spoke about that, we have been struggling with that for many years and trying to achieve that funding base. And it's kind of been one step forward and two steps back, but we are sincerely grateful for all of the support that we've gotten. In fact, we pride ourselves on being outcome-based and providing transparent reporting for all of our dollars, and we pride ourselves on that ongoing relationship with the legislature. The increase to our base would establish a new annual base of $2,952,652 in total state contribution, which is an increase of $691,552 per year. CILs are a good return on investment. Not only do we provide quality services and keep people living independently, but we save taxpayers millions of dollars per year. We provided 280 with nursing home relocations with a cost savings of $23 million per year, or $15 million after adjustments are made with factoring and waivered services and things like that. So when we receive funding, it's not really a handout. It's really a return on investment, because we're saving money in denying people the freedom to live in the most integrated settings and putting them in higher cost, more confined living situations. For many people, we don't understand the issues that many with disabilities face. We don't understand that some people sustain themselves on macaroni and cheese and French onion dip, literally, or that the simple fact that they're unable to manage their own money and keep track of the complex set of forms and paperwork that are required to sustain themselves ends up tripping them and putting them into the further into the system and into a higher cost setting. Our services keep people living independently. We work with them in all areas of life, from self-esteem, sexuality, financial management, communication, transportation, housing, employment, cooking, nutrition, you name it, in addition to the other services that I mentioned. I want to thank Senator Dibble for authoring this bill for us, and Mr. Chair, for your continued support throughout the years to Centers for Independent Living. I'd take questions.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I've seen firsthand how good this program is, and I know what good work they do and how valuable it is to keep people in the community and living independently where you can. And so I appreciate this. I know this is a big increase in the funding base that we have right now, Senator Dibble, and so on. I'm not sure if we can do it this year or not, but it certainly is a worthy cause. Does anybody have any we'll try and get some money to it, I think, if we can. Anybody have any questions?
Well, we can get, Mr. Chair.
Yes, okay. Sir.
All right. So no comments or questions. Then do you have any final comments?
Any consideration is greatly appreciated. At one point, there was a run at this entire funding area. It was going to be zeroed out in a previously proposed budget, and you, of course, prevented that. We're grateful for that. But it's time to move ahead. This is very cost-effective service. It's a return on the dollar.
It's as good as it gets, that's for sure. So, all right, thank you very much. And so we'll leave the Senate files 2640 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair members.
If the committee will indulge me, I'm just going to sit here and do this bill. Ms. Dietrich, why don't you just go up to the table there? What I'll do, the easiest way for me to be the chair and have you the author of the bill is to let you just tell everybody what's going on here, so that way we can explain it. This is Senate File 2161. It's relating to a director of the school trust fund, permanent school fund, and so Ms. Dietrich's been very, very involved in this and worked on it extremely hard when she was in the legislature, and now she's still involved in it and explain to the committee members exactly what we're trying to do here. So, Ms. Dietrich, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Denise Dietrich, and I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent every school board member in the state, which consists of over 2,000 school board members, and we have done so proudly since 1920, the same year that Hibbing High School was was constructed. First of all, I want to thank the authors, Senator Tomasoni, Saxog, Bach, and Engelbritzen, and Senator Hoffman for authoring this piece of legislation. For many, it may just be considered a technical change or a correction to something that was passed earlier. And so in that vein, let me explain why that is. In the 2012 legislature, we passed a bill that created and funded the position of the school trust lands director, and it also funded the Legislative Permanent School Fund Commission. This bill passed with a strong bipartisan support in the legislature, was agreed upon with the governor and also with the DNR, and along with strong support from the Minnesota School Boards Association. It was the intent of the author of the bill and the legislature that a school trust lands director would be appointed by the governor in July of 2013, using the revenue generated from the school trust lands. The governor did not appoint a school trust lands director, saying that the statute required, and I quote, money as appropriated by the legislature, which you will find on page on line 1.13 of the bill. So, as I mentioned, he said that it took legislative action to allocate that money from the school trust fund revenue. Since that point, when no director was appointed by the governor, the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources appointed his own school trust lands administrator. His salary is paid for from the revenue generated by the school trust lands, I want to point out that it is approved by the legislature. So what we are doing is we are correcting this now that we understand why the governor has not appointed this position, which the legislature has a real strong message that this person should be appointed. What we have is before you is Senate File 2161, and it clarifies where the funding for the school trust lands director would come from. It would come on line 1.11 from the state forest suspense account. And it does not need to be appropriated by the legislature because, as you may know, the school trust lands generates revenue on its own, and the DNR has access to the state forest suspense account and can pay for the creation of that position and the salaries.
The council is telling me that there's a technicality here. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Dietrich, this does not contain an appropriation. The money would still have to be appropriated. The suspense account is just used to repay the general fund or whatever source of money comes out. But I think you still need this doesn't appropriate. It doesn't use the term appropriation. It's not appropriated. Generally, we don't appropriate directly from the forest suspense account. What that money is, it's held for because it's constitutionally necessary because you can only because the net proceeds have to go into the fund. So this is where the money is held, and then generally now DNR has costs certified that are appropriated out of other funds, and it's certified, then this money is used to put back into those funds. I think without an appropriation, I don't think this would get the money out the door.
Do we need more language here?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think you would need to – I think the best way to do this – I mean, this was a directive to the administration for the 2013 session, and they didn't come in with a recommendation for it. What I think probably the ideal way to do this, instead of amending this law, would be to amend 16A.125 and allow for these costs to be certified and then appropriated out of whatever source you're going to use for it, either be the Forest Management Investment Account or the general fund, and then you would have that law, same as we do right now for DNR, allow for certification of those costs, and then it would be reimbursed. That's how we do it right now for the Department of Natural Resources. Like I said, this law was meant to be one time. It was meant to be a directive to the next legislature and the next administration, but it wasn't. I mean, the administration didn't come in with a recommendation.
So can we fix the language right here?
Mr. Chair, I think it would be a little more than we can do orally.
All right. Okay.
If you want for the bill, we can do that.
All right. Okay. Ms. Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The intent of the legislation was to take it out of the forestry suspense account and that it would be certified at the end of the year. Now, it is, the DNR already certifies many different categories of costs on a yearly basis: administration, management, road improvement, fire suppression, and one more that I'm missing. And so I don't see why that, and they don't get legislative authority to certify any of those costs. They just write their certification report at the end of the year. They give it to the Department of Revenue, and they look at the categories and see if they are legal or not, and then say, okay, and the DNR collects their money.
And Mr. Chair, it's Dietrich. That's true, but what it does is, my understanding, the way the law and suspense account works is it just replenishes those funds from which the money was appropriated. It doesn't. What it says is at the end of the year, and I don't have it in front of me, but at the end of the year, that the Department of Management budget certifies those costs, and then they are then transferred back into those funds. A big chunk goes into the Forest Management Investment Account, and then some into the general fund, depending on where. The big one for the general fund was always the firefighting, but of course we aren't doing that anymore. We aren't certifying those costs against the suspense account anymore, starting this current fiscal year. But my understanding is that the money is appropriated in the regular budgeting process to those agencies, and then the money then gets certified, and the money gets placed back into those accounts. In fact, I've got it in front of me. After a fiscal year, the commissioner shall distribute the receipts credited to the suspense account during the fiscal year as follows: the amount of certified costs incurred for the forest management, forest improvement, and road improvement during this shall be transferred to the forest management investment account. The balance of certified costs should be transferred to the general fund. So I think the way to do this, if people want the money to be appropriated, but the other issue is that the money would be appropriated in Senator Saxhog's division, because it's the money to the legislature and it's money to the Department of Administration. But then to certify those costs against the suspense account, similar to what we do with DNR, I think would be the proper way to do it.
Go ahead, Ms. Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that is the way that we thought that this would happen, is that the DNR would just then include these costs in their certification process on a yearly basis.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Dietrich, this gives some direction to do that, but it still doesn't appropriate the money. You can't spend money from that. We generally don't spend money directly from that account. That gets reimbursed. I mean, that becomes a funding source for those accounts.
Well, it sounds like what you read, though. It sounds just like this, what you just got done reading.
Right, but Mr. Chair, but there's money appropriated out of the general fund and out of those accounts to the DNR for the purpose of conducting the activity. And then once they're certified, then the money goes back in. The money gets taken from the suspense account and put into those funds at the end of the year.
Yeah, that's what it says here. It says that she'll come from that account.
Mr. Chair, it's not appropriated anywhere.
What does shall come from mean?
It doesn't mean appropriated. It doesn't mean appropriated.
Shall be appropriated? If we put that in there, would that work?
You could, Mr. Chair, but it's not. Generally, this should be codified. If we're going to do this on a regular basis, it should become part of 16A.125. rather than being an uncodified section of law, because this only does it for a couple of years, and then it would leave it up to whoever after that to continue to do it.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, for what it's worth, I guess I'd be more than willing to. Is the proper motion to table here until we get this fixed? I mean,
Mr. Chair, I'm assuming that. I don't thought want to is that this would be laid over for possible inclusion.
Yeah,
and not
yeah
and
it can be fixed.
And we'll fix it in the meantime.
Yeah.
Mr. Meyer, are you just sitting there, or do you want to say something?
Trying to hide behind the.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources, and Mr. Knopf is right. The language does need some work. I think the intent is there, though. We do have some concerns about, one is the position, and two, just relying on the sole source of funding from forestry activities, since most of the revenue in the trust comes from minerals activities, and a lot of the work that our trust lands director is doing is dealing with land sales and examinations as well. So relying, funding the position solely on forestry receipts may or may not be the best thing to do. We've been having conversations with the Permanent School Trust Fund Commission and also in the House with the authors of the bill, and our concern is one of what is the best long-term interest of the trust, having this position in administration and our position in the DNR, or trying to clarify how this position should work and looking for a better solution, which is what we're thinking about doing. With our trust lands director within the DNR, he has direct day-to-day contact with the land managers of the state. The position that's in administration right now that would be funded with this bill would not have direct connection to the trust land managing divisions within the DNR. By virtue of being within the DNR but outside of the managing divisions like Aaron Vanderlind is right now and reporting directly to the commissioner's office, the administrator can engage directly with managers while retraining the independence needed to fulfill the fiduciary responsibility of the trust. When we were working on this bill back in 2012, the vision was basically to have this trust lands administrator, a couple staff, I think the budget was about $500,000 a year, to do virtually the same thing that we're doing internally within the department now. So we understand the desire to have a trust lands administrator working on these lands daily, trying to maximize the revenue being brought from these lands, looking at lands that should be sold, exchanged, benefiting the long-term fiduciary health of the trust. We would just like to try to figure out how to do that in the best fiscally method possible, or the cost-efficient way possible, and also looking at avoiding duplicity. So our desire is to have this position, those duties transferred to the DNR. I know your bill doesn't do that, but we would like to have those discussions with you as you move forward.
Senator Rood.
Mr. Chair, I am the vice chair of that committee, and I think it's been very, very, very clear with that commission and that committee that we want an arm's length and we don't want this. The legislation made this an administrator not within the DNR for a very good purpose, and that was to have that arm's length distance between what was best for the children, and not the DNR doesn't have the best interest of the children. But I think in all of the hearings that we've had, and we just had one this morning, that's been a very clear message that this legislation was to be a position not within the DNR.
Yeah, and I agree. That's why we have it here in front of us. And it would seem to me, though, Mr. Meyer, that there would be a way to have this position and still be able to communicate directly with the staff of the DNR as the current commissioner, acting commissioner does, and maybe even utilize your staff, I would think. Now, whether or not that gets us to the arm's length that we're talking about, I'm not sure, but it certainly does allow the new commissioner, to have some kind of contact with the DNR and all the people who are on the ground doing the things that you just got done talking about. So maybe we can work something out there. So in that way, it wouldn't cost $500,000. It only costs about $150,000.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate those comments, and that's exactly what we're looking for, is how do we create efficiencies and avoid duplicity? I think this position in admin and our current staff position would basically be doing the same thing, talking to each other about doing the same things where we might be able to accomplish the same goals in a more cost-efficient manner.
And I'm not sure if that works right or not, but you wanted to comment, Ms. Dietrich, did you?
Yeah. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to touch on a couple of different items here. First of all is the argument of duplicity. If what we were trying to do was not effective, first of all, the DNR commissioner would not have appointed his own administrator. And because now they are very happy with what their own administrator has been doing, now they are saying what we wanted to do originally would be duplicative. And it was the chair of the Environment Committee that actually said to the DNR during the last hearing on this bill, which those issues were not brought up, was that if you want to avoid duplicity, just take the person that the commissioner appointed and move them to the Department of Administration, and that would also avoid that issue as well. To the point that Senator Rood made, this bill originally started getting discussed because of the fact that these are trust lands, and they are held in trust for the beneficiaries, which are the children of this state. And for many years, they have been abused, and there has not been the appropriate oversight and accountability for these lands. Because of a newfound interest, all of a sudden it doesn't make 50, 60, 70 years of abusing these lands and not giving the children of this state one trustee right. And we are not talking about change that just makes this commissioner happy, this legislature happy. What we are trying to do is make systemic change that will serve the children of this state for the next 100 years. And that's what we all have to keep in mind. Because the minute somebody looks away, all of a sudden poor behaviors and poor policies start become policy again, and then there is abuse in the system. And so I strongly still contend that this was the intent of the legislation. It was agreed upon by the governor and the DNR, and that we ought to fulfill that obligation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Root.
And Mr. Chair, I do want to say that Mr. Vandalin has done a really tremendous job since he has been appointed, and he's been a great administrator and advocate for the trust and the fiduciary responsibility. So he has done a very good job in doing that. It would be wonderful if he could have the, you know, admin position at that arm's length.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Any other comments or questions from anybody? Okay. Mr. Brandt, you're not sitting there because you want to comment, do you? Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Seeing no further comments or questions, then we'll figure out how to get this language correct and see how we can get this thing worked out. And we may have to send it over to Senator Saxhog. I don't know, but if that's the case, we'll...
He said you could go ahead.
He said I could go ahead and take care of it. Real nice guy. Okay. All right. With that, we'll lay Senate File 2161 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Senator. Thank you. And with that, we got anything on the agenda for Wednesday yet? Or?
Lots of stuff.
Okay. All right. Well, you'll be getting notices from our crack staff on Wednesday's hearing. So, meeting adjourned.